The exhibition is accompanied by a weekly musical performance series in the galleries, special conversations with artists and musicians, tours, and more. Visit hammer.ucla.edu and kpfk.org for more information.
This is KPFK
90.7 FM,
Los Angeles.
From the icy cold curves of Angeles Crest to the sunny shores of PCH, this is the Car Show, broadcasting this Saturday and every Saturday for over 53 years here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, Southern California, and heck, all of Southern California. I am joined this week by my favorite co-host in the world, Michelle Spencer, a practicing attorney, a member of the Motor Press Guild, owner of many Mazdas, and I could go on and on, but we only have 58 minutes. Welcome, Michelle.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me again, and happy to be here with you to talk more about cars and car books.
Indeed. Today we have a very special guest. This is a different day, so if you're expecting us to have our calendar section, our news section, our reviews, that is not going to happen. Brace yourself for an entirely new format today only on the Car Show. We have a special guest, an old friend of mine, somebody I've always admired. Whenever I was on the MPG board, the Motor Press Guild, we would give awards. And if this guy ever entered, there was just no reason to even hold meetings because it was obvious who was going to win the award. Nobody else could formulate a sentence. This guy formulates entire books. Anyone who grew up reading race reports from Europe in the decades generally considered the golden age of racing knows the name of our guest. He has covered Formula One, sports cars, Le Mans. I think he covered Targa Florio. He'll correct me on that, I'm sure. And everything in between. He has a new book coming out that we will get to in a minute. But for now, please welcome Pete Lyons.
Oh, Mark, that's too much pressure. I can't do this, man.
You got to live up to it, man.
Thank you very much.
It's like Revson at Le Mans or something. The pressure's on and you can do it.
Exactly right. We're just talking to friends here.
Tell us about the new book that you have.
Yes.
It's coming out, I think, February, March, we don't know exactly. I've already paid my own money. I did not get a review copy. I paid my own money to the Pete Lyons Foundation or whatever it's called.
Attaboy.
And Michelle is going to too.
You're both welcome. Thank you very much, both of you. It's called, it's basically my memoir, my autobiography. And I thought I would just put my name on the top of it, Pete Lyons. Pete Lyons has to talk louder here, Mark, my boss is saying. It's called Pete Lyons, My Travels on Racer Road. And it's basically a story of my life, how I got into this business, how it developed, why I got to do what I did and have the most incredible good fortune along the way. I'm just plain luck, but I grabbed it. And I've spent, I'm still doing it, as a matter of fact, and I'm considerably older than you two are. So
I don't know.
Still a lot of fun.
Considerably older. You're older than Michelle, but I'm pretty close. But tell us the name of the book and where people can get it.
Yes, you can get it from my own website, which is PeteLyons.com. That's all one word, PeteLyons. Remember the Y and remember the S, please, .com. And the book is called Pete Lyons, My Travels on Racer Road. And it's $95, and if you buy from our website, you get my autograph with it, plus, you know, any friendly addendum you would like me to put with it.
Okay, great. And let's just get right into it, because we're down to, oh my goodness, we started with 58 minutes, we're down to 54 minutes, and we have a lifetime of racing memories to pack into this. I want to start with one of my favorites. I, too, am a humble a scribbler here trying, living in the shadow of the great Pete Lyons. I can't possibly match him. And I have in my head this memory of my favorite Pete Lyons story, which he tells me is not even a correct memory. So I can't even get the memory right. But in my mind, his description of being at the Mulsanne Strait or if you can pronounce Hunan Dieri's straight, use that. Go right ahead. At Le Mans, in the middle of the night, he snuck out there. And the way that I remember this, I think I read it at Auto Week in Detroit. So that would have been 35 years ago when we used to have to come in on Sunday night and work all night to send the magazine out. So this is how I remember it. Him sitting in the tall grass at the middle of the Hunan Dieri, Mulsanne Strait, because no one can pronounce Hunan Dieri's. And this is how I remember it. Crickets. The stab of headlights. Roar of Matra flat 12. Doppler shift. Crickets. That's how I remember it. And that was completely wrong. Pete, straighten me out.
Well, gosh, if I could write as concisely as you always do, I could have gotten away with that. Gee, why didn't you tell me then and there? I spent all night writing that stupid story.
It was actually a little bit longer than that. It was my story for Auto Week of the 24 Hours of Le Mans 1973. And a Matra did win, M-A-T-R-A, as a lot of you probably know. But I opened it with an impression of, as I said, sneaking in through the fence and going through some trees and right up to the guardrail along the middle of the Mulsanne Strait. And this passage I've actually extracted, and it's in the prologue of the book. It's the beginning of the book, and appeared in Auto Week. The 24 hours isn't a race like other races. Instead, it's sneaking at night through the forest along the Mulsanne Strait, up nearly to the guardrail. Not right up because of fear, but nearly. If you're lucky, there will be a pause in the 180-mile-per-hour traffic, and you hear a Matra coming. It starts far down through the forest, just a thin, shapeless noise, a shrill cry broken by a million tree trunks into white noise, like the sound of falling water. Very rapidly it swells in volume, and then suddenly the top leaves of the trees flare with a brilliant white light. The light shifts in rays down the trunks, and the noise rises to become the only noise in the world. A sudden thrill of panic seizes your heart. It's like the last instant standing under the glide path as a 747 comes down on you, and it's too late to run away. By now, through the rushing noise, you can distinguish the central shriek of the engine. 12 tiny pistons straining at top speed and angry they can't go faster. The noise hurts your ears. The light hurts your eyes. For just an instant, you glimpse the car, a flash like sunshine on a bullet. Then it is gone, hurling away down through the trees, a dwindling pool of light and two red sparks converging. The noise, beamed straight back at you now by two long exhaust pipes, is pure and clean, but astonishingly lower in pitch. It fades away rapidly, but you can still hear it for a long, long time. I wanted to express the magic of what I was doing all those years, and I thought I'd start with that because that was one of the most magical 60 seconds I've had.
The Matras, how many of us were lucky enough to hear a Matra? I don't think I've ever heard one. And they had flat 12 engines. Is that right, Pete?
It was actually a V12.
A V12, okay.
Right.
And they were just howling loud, and yet it sounds like, from your description, it was a wonderful sound to hear.
It was. It was one of the top four motor racing engine sounds I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, and you've heard a lot of engine sounds. Let's go ahead then with more stories from Pete Lyons. If you're just joining us, this is a motorsports journalist, Pete Lyons, who has just come out with a new book that you can get at PeteLyons.com. That's LYONS.com. And it's 90 something bucks. It'll be the best 90 bucks you've ever spent. Go ahead and get one. Pete, you were telling me about your memory. One of your most distinct memories is of a Chaparral. Now, I remember the Chaparral. I had one of those model kits when I was a kid, and it looked so cool. There were no stickers on it. There's no color. Now you can't even see the shape of a car because it's all buried under sponsorship logos. But back in those days, You had Jim Hall making the chaparrals with just plain one monochromatic color on them. Tell us about your favorite memory of a chaparral.
The chaparrals were an amazing little closet industry down in Texas, way out in the Midlands plains near Midland, Texas. And he had a bunch of tin sheds in a little private racetrack, and he developed the most amazingly advanced racing cars. And for the 1966 Can-Am season, which was the first year of the Can-Am, and I can talk more about that series in a minute, he came up with something we had never seen before. It had a wing mounted on the top of that car, straight above the rear wheels, and it put the downforce down right onto the rear wheels themselves. It did not go onto the chassis, so that your downforce is applied straight to the tires, and it didn't require any heavier springs on the car. And the driver could also feather the wing. Coming out of the corner, he would feather the wing straight, and you get a speed boost down the straight.
Active aero,
exactly.
Illegal now.
Well, unless you were having Formula One, then you have to have it. But we won't go there right now. We had seen pictures of it, but I had never seen one before. This was at Bridgehampton, 1966, in September. And in years since, I've tried to distill what that car did to me just seeing it for the first time swooping over the Bridgehampton. It was out at the end of Long Island on the top of a bunch of sand hills with some scrub oaks around, and it was a remote area, and to have a racetrack out there was marvelous. So I did a Fast Lines column for Vintage Motorsport, 10 years or so ago, and I called that Chaparral, the soul of the Can-Am. And this is the part I wrote that I'm going to read to you. Winging over the scrub-clad dunes, it looks like a space invader executing a surprise and awe ground attack on a remote outpost. We have never seen such an otherworldly apparition, never even imagined such a thing. Yet here it is, leaping over the skyline to strafe our raceway with fire in its belly and conquest in its heart. Not all of us flee screaming, but even at that moment, I believe we all know, upon us has come a revolution in racing.
And it certainly was. Wow. Jim Hall was an iconoclast. He was everybody was making it up as they went along there, and Jim Hall was maybe making it up a couple steps ahead of everybody else. That must have been quite a sight. That's one of my favorite photos that you've taken, was the Chaparral at Bridgehampton. Of course, that track's long gone. It's now a housing track, right?
It's basically a golf course.
A golf course, good. Excellent use of land. Yeah, let's bulldoze the race tracks and put up a golf course, because we don't have enough of those. Why do people play golf? I don't know. Anyway, it's so easy to get sidetracked here. But you have a picture, because you also sell these pictures on your website, plyons.com. LYONS. And you can see the pure white chaparral on the black asphalt with the green oaks. And I think in the background is the blue Atlantic Ocean, or is it Long Island Sound?
That is Long Island Sound, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that was pretty neat. So you had to shoot your own pictures throughout your career, right? Most of the time, I would imagine.
There were times when I worked with a professional that the magazine had assigned, but I always took my own pictures anyway. I've always felt that words and pictures are two different ways to get at the same thing. And times when I've, for one reason or another, only done writing or only done photography, I felt like one hand was tied behind my back.
And you kept all that stuff, all those negatives and everything.
Those that the magazines had the courtesy to return, yes.
I'm sure that was an auto week, but we're not going to talk about that right now. I'm sure that was some other outlet.
There were more than one.
I had a couple of boxes of negatives, because in those days everybody shot 35 millimeter film. When I moved from Europe after covering Formula One in the late 80s and sports prototypes and Le Mans, it would have cost me, I think, $3 or $4 to ship the box home. And so I left it. And so somewhere in Europe, there's a box, or somewhere in a European landfill, there's a box of my pictures, but they were not anywhere near as nice as Pete's Pictures, as we all know. Okay, we have so many topics. We went through a list of topics here that we wanted to get to, and we're just going to keep going through them because we've only got, what's 58 minus 15? Somebody do the math on that. But we only have a limited amount of time. So the next memory, this again, folks, if you're just joining us, is motorsport journalist Pete Lyons, who is a California resident. So he's not far. He lives within the sound of KPFK 90.7 FM. And maybe he'll listen to this on Saturday, as we're hoping you are too. Pete Lyons is a motor racing journalist who has dedicated his life to this sport and has apparently enjoyed almost the whole time of it. And so we're going to move on. Pete's next memory, a racer in Buenos Aires. Tell us.
After 6 years of covering the Can-Am for England's Autosport magazine, Auto Week, what Mark was involved with, they hired me to go on the Formula One circuit. And then when I sent a letter to Autosport telling them that I couldn't do the Can-Am for them anymore, that I was doing Auto Week's Formula One stories, they said, well, actually, Peter, this comes at a good time. Would you like to do it for us as well? So I went to Europe with two assignments to do stories for the same series. This marvelous. And both clients were perfectly happy with it because they didn't have overlapping readership. And so my very first event was in Buenos Aires, Argentina, the Argentine Grand Prix in January of 1973. And I'd never been south of the equator before. Excuse me. And we had seen Formula One in the States, but somehow Formula One on the international circuit, particularly at the beginning of the year, was extra sharp and intense. And this little vignette encapsulates my first impressions of my first international Grand Prix, and I've never forgotten it. It's a last-minute qualifying attempt by Ronnie Peterson. I don't know if you guys can hear me still.
We can still hear you.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to speak up. Project to the last row of the audience, because this broadcast goes all the way from Bakersfield to the Mexican border. So you have to get everybody there, Pete.
Well, hello, Bakersfield. I've been there numerous times.
Back out there. There's a half mile dirt track, right? Michelle likes
Kern County. Yes. Yeah. Kevin Harvick's Kern County Raceway. Yeah.
There it is.
I went to the Moroso, to the drag strip there on the old airport.
Oh, Famoso, yeah.
Famoso, that's Famoso, right.
Famoso, but that's where they hold the NHRA, what is it? It used to be called the Motorsports Reunion, NHRA Motorsports Reunion, and I think that the March meet, as it was called, and I don't know if they still do it in March. We'll follow up on that with our next show, but Pete's bringing us down to Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires, however you say it. I'm mispronouncing everything on this show. Go ahead, Pete.
No, you got that one right. Anyway, there was the guy who was generally considered the fastest driver of that era, sort of the Max Verstappen of his age. It was Ronnie Peterson, a Swedish driver. And he was just magic in a race car. And he came around on his last lap of qualifying, driving harder than anyone could have believed, harder than he'd ever tried before. And this is how I tried to put it into words. It was the last minute of the last qualifying. A black and gold wedge-shaped Lotus 72 darted into sight. The helmet, blue and yellow. Ronnie Peterson. His chassis was brand new and had been giving trouble throughout practice. This would be his final chance of a decent starting position. In obvious desperation, he came hurtling into the tight left-hander, pressing every pedal at once. With the tail already well out, he bounced his inside front wheel off the apex curb right across from where I was standing. That knocked the back-out end even further, and the car wiped sideways across to the outside and slid both back wheels up on the sloping exit curbing. It was at that kind of angle. But Ronnie's right foot was already pushing a dent in the bulkhead, and he never lifted. With the poor Cosworth screaming at redline, both fat rear Goodyears broke loose and plumed off layers of blue smoke 3 inches deep.
Then the long black dart rebounded crazily headfirst to the middle of the track. It was still canted very far sideways, front wheels cocked all the way over, rear wheels painting two jet-black streaks of molten rubber. Years of railbirding told me that Ronnie Peterson had lost that car. Even if he managed somehow to catch the wild slide before it became a hopeless spin, at the very least there would be a series of unruly, time-wasting fishtails. Nope, not one. Exactly as the 72 reached the center of the road, it snapped precisely back into alignment with it, and stayed aligned. There was not so much as a hint of a twitch the other way. Running straight and true, leaving nothing behind but noise, Super Swede cannoned on toward the stopwatches.
Wow.
Oh. Thank you.
That's Pete Lyons, ladies and gentlemen. You can get his book at PeteLyons.com, L-Y-O-N-S. Did Peterson get the pole?
No, he was a few tenths of a second too short. Too late.
Okay. And that must have been crazy getting to and from Argentina.
Actually, it's very simple in those days. I bought a ticket that took me on a complete circle for the whole year, outbound from New York City to Buenos Aires and back by way of Johannesburg and London. So I paid, I think, $1,200 to go basically around the entire Grand Prix circuit for, like 9 or 10 months. I thought it was a deal in those days.
Now, I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit, because in Europe, you had several different ways of getting around. Nowadays, everybody just flies and stays at a hotel and catches a shuttle to the track. It wasn't like that for you. You had a number of means once you landed on the continent or wherever you were of getting around. Could you tell us some of those?
Well, in fact, a lot of times I did do exactly what you said, but that wasn't my favorite way to go. I like to have my own wheels because I was not tied to going back to an office on Monday morning. I was free for 10 days till the next Grand Prix, or 7 days to the next race if it was a non-Grand Prix event I was covering. So I liked to drive. So I'd be, say, in the south of France, and I could drive slowly up through Germany to the Nürburgring. Then I could drive slowly across France to Rouen or someplace like that. So I loved that. But I also enjoyed trying different ways to do it. And so the first 2 years, I had a Chevy Corvette over there. I told you I got an assignment to do stories for two different publications. Each of them paid me independently. So that was probably the most money I've made in myself and my life. It wasn't lavish, but I could afford to buy a brand new Corvette, a 73 Stingray.
Right. That's lavish.
It is. It is lavish. It was I paid $5,800 for it, and it was delivered in Rotterdam for $7,200 total price. And so that was my wheels in Europe. And I wrote this 30 years after that, Mark, for Auto Week. I wrote this. Kevin Wilson, who was executive editor at that time, he asked me, he remembered the car, and he said, why don't I write a 30-year retrospective of the car? So this is part of what that was. This one is a little bit longer, so if anybody wants to take a bathroom break, too bad. We sealed our love one wild night in Sicily. My brand new 73 Corvette and I had just galloped down the length of Italy. Our target, the Targa Florio open road race. And by the time we drove off the ferry at Messina, the mountainous, mysterious island loomed in darkness. I might be a little tired, I suggested. I'm not, she said. So we dashed on. This relationship was still in its first week, and neither of us was sure we'd picked wisely. To her, bred and born in Middle America, the then unlimited roads of old Europe must have been otherworldly. For me, well, she sure was hot, but how would I feel in the morning? Our wicked tryst began on a crazy whim. Excited by landing the fantasy assignment to cover Formula One, I bought and shipped overseas an appropriate set of wheels. A new Stingray Coupe, high-performance small-block, close-ratio manual, paint code Targa Red.
It was nothing but a cold-blooded investment, I assured my scandalized other self. I wouldn't be keeping this utterly impractical contraption. Once the rich European playboys around the GP circuit saw the flamboyant Yank tank, surely they'd beseech me to buy it. Maybe then I could afford something more deft, like a Lotus or Porsche. Meantime, I would show her the storied namesake of her hue. The Targa Florio was endangered, I knew, flat-out racing over 44 miles of narrow mountain roads, naked rock faces and gaping drop-offs, spectators literally on the edges of the pavement. It was a wonder that this relic of ancient times had survived this long. It seemed important to be present at what might be the last ever running. Did the car sense the drama of the quest? Was there some primeval motorsports spirit rising out of the age-battered asphalt, which had been part of the Giro di Sicilia race route as recently as 1958? Or maybe I was simply overtired. Whatever, Mademoiselle Vette seemed to come alive that night. Our drive along the incredibly sinuous road along the northern coastal of Sicily was hallucinogenic. Hairpins and switchbacks and blind curves. Potholes and patches and fallen rocks. Tree trunks and power poles and stone walls. At intervals, we'd find ourselves coursing dim-lit village streets. Then we'd hurtle out into blackness again. On the left, the headlights indicated towering cliffs. On the right, nothing. A wheel put wrong would plunge us straight down into Homer's wine-dark sea. I'd chosen against power steering. Such choices could be made in those days. And this road was work. The corners were coming in endlessly. In defense of my tiring arms and hands, I was using more and more brake and throttle to get the car turned. The car seemed to like it. She had grunt, that girl. Those were real muscles under those curves. Probably I didn't need to be shifting as much as I was, but I liked the feel of the gearbox, silky, and shifting made good engine sounds. I liked looking at her, too, the rhythmic triple rise of her fenders and hood against the illuminated road. This was the most exhausting piece of road I'd ever seen. Would it never end? And what was I thinking, taking a piece of American iron into the darkness of lower Europe? This car was too big for her, too heavy, too thirsty. What if it broke down, tonight, here on this lonely road? I love this road, she said. I hope it never ends. And so I did not offer her for sale, not that season, nor the next, nor the next. After we watched the Targa together, we raced back up the entire length of Italy, all the way into the Alps, in one mighty 18-hour day. We didn't want it to end. She'd only be 30 now, wherever she is. Bet she's still hot.
That is a car review. So we've done the car review section right in the middle. If you're joining us, that is Pete Lyons, motorsports journalist par excellence, who is joining us for the entire hour. We are sharing excerpts from his new book about his lifetime of covering motorsports. Book is available, as well as many photographs and other memorabilia and Lyons et ceterini available at PeteLyons.com. That's L-Y-O-N-S. .com. Pete, if I tried to turn in a car review like that, especially working for Hearst right now, I think I would have to go and visit HR, and I'd have to watch a whole bunch of those videos from HR and everything else. Back in those days, you could get away with so much more, and I think the world was a better place, at least as far as car reviews went, especially the ones that you wrote. So you don't know where the Corvette is now.
Not currently, no. 20 years after that, a guy who owned it in Wales contacted me, and I went to visit the car. So it was alive and well then, but I don't know about
Did you drive it?
No. He did not offer to let me drive it, and I was good with that because he changed a lot. He lowered the rear suspension, but not the front. He'd put different tires on it. He put on power steering, which I never liked. And so I was just happy to ride with it in the car because it wasn't my car any longer.
And what was the Targa Florio like? Was that, were they, Yeah, go on. Go with that.
Well, if you can imagine a rugged mountain in the middle of the Mediterranean, off the toe of Italy, it's like the football being hit by the toe of the leg of the boot of Italy. The northern, it's all mountainous. The eastern end has got this incredible mountain, Mount Etna. It's a gigantic volcano still active. And I've got a whole chapter in the book talking about walking up to the summit of that. But we're going back to the other end of the island, the western end, where the Targa Florio is. And it ran along the seafront and then turns left and went up into the mountains and up through river valleys and over a crest and down into another river valley, up over another crest, through villages and past farms and through open countryside. The very few guardrails, most of the guardrails were the form of little kilometer stones. Every kilometer, there'd be a little marker stone that tells you what kilometer it was. Otherwise, you were perfectly free to fly off the road on the outside if you wanted to. There were something like 600 or 700 corners around the circuit, they said. Everyone was different. Everyone was right next to the other one, except for this single 2.5 mile straightaway along the seafront that was just absolutely dead flat, and those cars were going 180-odd miles an hour. Through villages, past phone poles, houses, bars, gas stations, just screaming at high speed with people right on the edge of the road watching it. It wasn't as bad as the old Mille Miglia where they were in the road, but they were like 2 steps away from the road.
And I assume that when it was canceled for safety reasons.
In fact, the event still goes on, but it's more of a rally. Yeah, that 72 was, I went back in 70, I'm sorry, I was there. 73 was the last of the real races.
Right.
After that, it was kind of a time speed thing, I think.
Those were the 917s.
I don't think they ever raced a 917 there. Porsche's 908, the little 3-liter car. That
Quick Vic Elford was the guy.
He was there. Brian Redman was there.
Yep. Oh, great times, great times. I never saw it myself. In 73, I was 13.
On your next junket to Europe, try to go there, Mark, because it's still alive. The place is alive. Everybody knows about it. There's a little museum. There's historical societies. You could drive the circuit. It's not very much changed at all. Pictures I took 50 years ago, I can still see them in the online representations of the village streets today.
And this is just one of the memories that will be recounted for you if you buy. Again, we are not getting a dime off of this. In fact, it is costing us money to have this, but we're featuring it because I've been a fan of Pete Lyons, and anybody who's read him should also be a fan for so many years. And it's such a great book. Michelle is even a fan, right?
Well, yeah.
We converted you so far.
The book is called My Travels on Racer Road.
Thank you.
If you've just tuned in.
Yeah, and we have motorsports journalist Pete Lyons here sharing his memories, which are also shared in his new book, My Travels on Racer Road, available at PeteLyons.com. This sounds like a pledge drive, but it's not. It's such a cool book and such a great life. And we are celebrating it here in the 58 minutes we have. How many minutes do we have left? We have about halfway through.
Yeah.
Michelle?
How about the foreword to your book? How did that come about?
The foreword, let me see now. What is the foreword?
It's Jackie, Sir Jackie Stewart.
Oh, Jackie. Excuse me. Yes, right. I was thinking of the introduction. No, Jackie Stewart, 3-time world champion, a guy I used to know every 2 weeks. He's always been very, very generous and kind to me. He wrote a very, very nice letter to Autosport, which was printed as a letter to the editor after a particularly nasty race in Spain in 1975. And they published it. And Jackie was very, very kind about me getting the story straight. And so when it came time to, see if we could get some big name attached to the book, frankly, I thought to reach out to Jackie. He very much likes to have people contribute to his foundation, which is to honor his wife, Helen, who's suffering from dementia. And it's the Race Against Dementia. Jackie Stewart is trying to bring motorsports enterprise swiftness of thought, quick reactions, technology to trying to cure this horrible disease that affects probably everybody in some way or another. So we were happy to get that, and Jackie wrote a really beautiful little introduction to the book.
Oh.
He's a great guy, and it must have been quite something different in those times where you knew all the drivers and they knew you, and everybody traveled together on this, as they called it, circus. And you could just go up and talk to them. It wasn't anywhere near as formalized as it is now.
I know. If I were doing it today, I would really miss that. Apparently, you can't see a driver unless somebody arranges it for you. The drivers do make themselves available, but often it's in a pen where they're behind a rope and they are circulated by their handlers around from one journalist to the next, to each of whom asks the same questions. And I can't find that very exciting. In my day, you used to be able to saunter along the pit road. The first time I ever saw Niki Lauda was at Watkins Glen during a practice session, and I knew who I would see there. But there was this slight little figure sitting on the guardrail across from where his race car was being worked on, and he was completely alone, and he was just sort of sitting there glowering at the car like, "I hate you. I have to make you better." And so I walked up and I introduced myself and said, "Can I say hi to you?" And he simply waved his hand to the guardrail. So I sat there for 15 minutes or so talking with a future 3-time world champion. It was so casual in those days.
And what was Niki like?
Niki was very reserved, perhaps you would say, impish in a way. Very blunt spoken, very man of few words, but when he did say something, it was worth listening to. One of the book's chapters is an interview I did with Niki in the 1976 season when there was a big hue and cry about not racing at the Nürburgring anymore, which was another circuit as notoriously, I suppose, dangerous is the accurate word, as the Targa Florio circuit, and Niki was one of the people who wanted us to stop racing there. I felt exactly the opposite, but I thought, let's ask him why. Let's get his story in print, and he was so happy to do that. He actually organized the press conference himself, and we sat somewhere for a whole hour chatting about it. And he's talking sharply, quickly, like this, and something, and every fifth word was a word I cannot say on the radio, you know. But I've transcribed that for the book, and I think it gives a really good insight into the mentality of the man, because he's very scientific, very precise, very exacting, as opposed to some of the other drivers who are much more laid back and happy guys.
Yeah, I might be misremembering this story too, as I probably am. As I get older, everything gets all fuzzy. But I think we had a deal where James Hunt was paid to write a column in Auto Week. Now, I might be misremembering this, or maybe he was paid by somebody else, but I thought it was Auto Week. And then somebody approached Niki, and we wanted Niki to write the story, write a column as well. And he said, "Well, how much are you?" And we said, "Well, how much money do you want for this? Because, you know, what kind of question is that to ask?" And he said, $1 more than James.
That's exactly correct. He told that to me. And that's what I reported to the magazine.
Ah, so my memory
wasn't a dollar. He said, £1 more than James.
Right.
That's great. That's great. Tell us, we have how much time? Oh, we have 20 minutes left.
Minutes, yeah.
Tell us about Can-Am.
Can-Am is something that doesn't seem to exist anymore. It was what we always said was it was the one of the thinnest rule books in racing. So many racing series are so, in my mind, restricted and chained down with rules and regulations. It seems like the more important thing is the rule and regulation and getting around it. Whereas the way I grew up was the idea that the rules and regulations were the laws of physics, and you wanted to get around those or use them to your advantage. And I just abhor the idea that somebody wants to restrict a race car. That's just wrong. I know there are arguments on the other side, but that's me talking here. And that I loved the Can-Am when it came along because it showcased this. It gave people a chance, a venue, an arena to exercise their technical creativity. And the winged Chaparral was one. We had cars with two engines. Chaparral made a car with two engines, which is perfectly legal. There were cars of all different descriptions, sizes, shapes. There was no regulation suggesting that or mandating the certain length or width or height of a car. There was no minimum weight. There was no restriction on tire sizes, no restrictions on the engine sizes. At the end of the Can-Am, we had 1,500 horsepower for qualifying laps, which is, you know, nowadays in Formula One, they're at 1,000, which was darned impressive back in the 70s. But so 750, 1,100 were, you know, phenomenal numbers for us back then. And the cars were, let's face it, they were technically primitive compared to today. They didn't have the aerodynamics. They didn't have the sophistication. The tires weren't, they were soft and floppy and slidey. But my God, you could see something big was going on. You'd watch a car come down and look through the turn one at the last turn at Road Atlanta, come down past the pits, and it's weaving and wobbling and sliding. There's leaving black streaks on the road, and the driver's left and right, and the steering wheel, and you think, whoa, I've just seen something fantastic. Going to the same kind of circuit with a modern car, a GTP or something, you'd watch the car come down there, and it's planted four square. It's steady. It's stable. The driver's just holding a steady speed, handlebar. Listen, Peter, you're talking cars here.
Steering wheel, maybe?
Steering wheel. That's what they call them.
Yeah, that's yeah.
Even yeah. Pete Lyons is capable of making an error. Look at that. Write this date down.
If I were writing this, I could fix it, but I can't fix my way of speech. Sorry.
You go ahead.
I just wanted to make the point that today's performance is spectacularly faster than it used to be. The cars are incredibly safer. They're amazingly reliable. The drivers are so much more fit. You have the radios. You have the computers. You have the calculators in the pits telling them what to do on the next lap, when to make the next pit stop. Whereas in the Can-Am, there were no radios. There were the signaling information came to the driver through a mechanic holding out a signboard with a couple of letters and numbers on it. And the driver had to work out what was going on himself. And at the same time, he's trying to hang on to this incredible wayward beast that was sliding and flopping and lifting wheels and power sliding and locking its brakes and rushing off the edge of the track and throwing up dust and grass. You could see, as I said, you could see something big was going on, and that's why I loved it.
There were domination. There were periods of domination in that. There was the McLaren, the Denny and
Bruce.
Brian and Denny.
Bruce and Denny.
Sorry. Oh man, everybody across Southern College is like, this idiot, Bruce Brian. He doesn't know. Okay. And there was that era of the McLarens. I believe it was the 8C, maybe.
They started with the 6A, then went to 6B, then they went to the M8 series of M8s, and ended with the M20.
And that was followed by the Porsches. That saw sort of toward the end of Can-Am. It was it sputtered on for a while, but those were the two great eras of this race. And one of your books, at least one of your books, is just about Can-Am, right? Are those out of print or still available?
All three. I've done three in the Can-Am. They're all out of print, but they are still available used. Unfortunately, we no longer have any in stock at the house here, but you can buy them used. Can-Am, Can-Am Photo History, and Can-Am Cars in Detail.
Okay. The beautiful books, too. The velocity stacks on top of the McLarens, where none of the pipes are straight. It looks like somebody planted flowers and velocity stacks came up out of the top of it. It's just beautiful. And you saw all this. You were there trackside listening to this, the thunder, the roar of these cars going down the starting line.
Yes.
In that era, were you more of a photographer? Were you a writer? Were you both?
I was doing both. I started out in photography because my dad was a photographer, but he worked weekends as a side hustle for Autosport magazine in England, and that's how I got involved in it. That's how I had sort of an in into autosport, because my dad was their North American correspondent. And he mostly did photography, and that's what I did. But then he did a little bit of writing, and I read all the magazine stories I could in those days. I was just mad about car racing. And I began to think, you know, I can't tell the whole story with pictures. I want to write as well. And so I remember coming home from a race at Watkins Glen one time, and I didn't have an assignment to write, but I thought, I'm ready to write. I'm going to write something. And I sat at my mom's typewriter, and I typed out two or three pages, and I thought, this isn't a race report. This is terrible. And I just crumpled the paper up and walked away, and I thought, I don't have it. I don't have it to be a writer. This is terrible. I'm so ashamed of myself. But a couple months later, I went out to Bridgehampton, and I decided to try again. And this time, I had a different approach to it, more like what I'm doing now. What I had been doing then, the failed attempt, was trying to copy what I'd read in some of the other magazines. Rather dry, rather straightforward, you know, step by step. You know, it was on a bright, shiny October morning, so-and-so in such-and-such a car completed so-and-so many laps at such-and-such a mile speed. Boring. You know, let's get the fire and shininess out in it, you know.
Leon used to tell us, of course, Leon Mandel, longtime publisher of Auto Week, used to tell us to go the race, the end of the race, is the culmination of weeks and weeks and weeks of events and developments and technology that led up to that. And that's the story that you tell. Did he ever tell you that too, Pete?
Not specifically, but Leon is the guy who sent me to Europe to do Formula One. It was the last race of the 72 season, and I was getting tired with the Can-Am. We already knew the McLarens were leaving. It was just going to be Porsche. And Porsches are wonderful cars, but you want more than one. And I had been doing it for 6 years anyway. I was getting tired. And I remember walking into the paddock, into the pit lane, probably on race morning, and there was the two white Penske Porsches warming up. Vroom, vroom. Right after them, the two papaya-colored McLarens with the big block V8s warming up. And beyond them, beyond four cars, was Leon Mandel. And you remember his voice. His voice could carry to the back of any auditorium. And he looked up at me and he says,
You're breaking up there, Pete. You're breaking up. You're breaking up. Sorry, you're screaming in your microphone there.
He's trying to do it.
It's the spirit of Leon came down and grabbed the microphone and twisted the cord.
Something happened.
I remember the way you told it was that he yelled across the grid, Lions, I have your life lined up for you, or something.
That's right.
Like that.
Yeah, it was, Lions, don't go away. I have your future all planned.
Yes. Oh. And indeed, he did your future for several years, and Auto Week was all the better for it. It was so much fun.
Pete, let me tell you.
So we have about 10 minutes left. I'm going down the list. We have so many things that I wanted to get in here. Tell us about some of the great drivers that you knew and liked. Just pick one and go with it.
Well, I've already talked about Jackie. Mario is another one. Mario Andretti, of course. And you'll see on the cover of the book, we've also invited Mario to contribute to it. I did that in the form of an epilogue where I called him up and we had a very wonderful, exciting, interesting conversation. And I've extracted that into kind of a chapter at the very end of the book. We call that the epilogue. And, I thank Mario for that, too. There was Bruce and Denny, of course, Bruce McLaren, Denny Holm, who were the Can-Am kings in the McLaren era of 5 years. Mark Donohue, a marvelous person. George Fulmer, who was a terrific driver. He was he was the final Can-Am champion. Lord, there's Niki Lauda, James Hunt, Emerson Fittipaldi.
Mark Donohue, because he was an engineer and a driver, and
yes,
of course he was paired with the best team with Penske. Tell us I don't think a lot of people know about Mark Donohue, and he was a significant figure in racing.
He was. You're right. He was not a flashy grabbing attention kind of guy. He was interested in working on the car. You go to the shop and Mark would be on the shop floor doing wheel alignments. I stopped in the Penske shop one day and there was Mark there aligning the wheels of his Indy car all by himself. You know, Penske had a few other people there, but Mark was tackling that particular job. Other drivers would be on the tennis court or on somebody's yacht, you know. Mark was not that kind of guy.
Yeah, he was hands-on.
He was also fairly soft-spoken, but he had a really sharp wit. He very mischievous, prankish guy. He'd, I don't know exactly how to say this, but he was very, very intelligent. Just he saw things and he noticed things. He'd remark on things, but he had kind of a devilish glint in his eye. You come to him and you'd ask him a question. What's the reason you do this to the car this weekend? He'd say, "I'm not going to tell you."
That doesn't happen. And, well, it does happen, and then they don't tell you. Mark probably told you ultimately. After
there were times when Mark was very, very forthcoming. Yes, right.
Who else? Pick another guy and tell us. I had a couple of encounters with Emerson Fittipaldi over the years, and I was just amazed. He had this quiet charisma that came from this immense confidence that he seemed to possess. I remember he was paid by some supercar developer, and of course all supercars fail, and this one ultimately failed. But I got to spend time with him, like riding around in the limo in Las Vegas and walking across the SEMA floor with him, and I was just amazed. He knew everything that was going on, and he controlled everything, you know, the conversation and everything, but he did it without making you think that he was doing it, you know? What was your impression of Emerson Fittipaldi?
All that fits. The Emerson I knew was younger, and he was driving for Lotus. I think it was maybe his first Grand Prix at Watkins Glen in 1970. I'm not sure it's the very first one he drove, but he won the race, and it was the first victory of the Lotus 72. 2 years later, he drove a 72 to the championship. He was Ronnie Peterson's teammate in Buenos Aires in 73 when I was there. So I could have written about Emerson too, but the guy that dropped my jaw was Ronnie. Emerson is a phenomenally focused, driven, intense individual. I don't mean tense. I mean he's focused. At the same time, he breaks into these incredible grins. If you've ever spoken with Brazilians, they might have this ability to just break into a smile that lights up the sun. They're such warm and happy and hearty people. I love Brazilians. Their beaches are pretty nice, too.
We saw it in Fast and Furious. I'm sure that was an accurate representation.
I'm sure.
Fast Five, excellent film. Again, so easy to get sidetracked. Bruce McLaren is a character. Everybody knows a McLaren when they see it going down the road now, but a lot of people can't trace it all the way back to this Kiwi who was just this brilliant man and a great leader. You spent a lot of time with Bruce McLaren. Tell us about him.
Well, he was another driver engineer. We had several of them in addition to Donahue. Dan Gurney had a lot of engineering ability and interest in him. Bruce, as people may know, came from a small town in New Zealand, and when he was quite young, he contracted a disease that crippled him. One leg ended up shorter than the other, so he always walked with a limp. But in fact, he spent the better part of 2 years, I think, living in a frame that was on wheels. He wasn't allowed to get out of it or walk around the hospital, so they'd have races between himself and the other patients with these things. It was like a four-wheeled wheelchair, which is a bed, if you can imagine that.
He probably won those races.
I imagine, but anyway, his father was keen on racing too, had been a driver. And so Bruce started driving in the backyard. Before he could drive on the road, he drove their plot of ground behind the house. Very, very early, he became very knowledgeable about racing, very skilled, very driven. And the New Zealander population, the motor racing people in New Zealand had a driver to Europe scheme. Every year they would club together, select one of the youngsters, and send them off for a year of Europe racing in Formula Three,
Formula Ford.
Formula Ford, I think it was.
Yep.
And Bruce was one of the recipients, and that started the whole McLaren enterprise you see today. But it was just one guy, one car. When he got to Cooper, he actually built his own car at Cooper. I mean, it was that kind of grassroots beginning.
We have 3 minutes left, so
I want more
about Southern California hero Dan Gurney.
Yes, absolutely. Dan is just we all miss Dan. He was a marvelous person. He was so instrumental in making racing appeal to the masses. Remember that I think it was a Car and Driver promotion to try to get Dan Gurney to run for president.
Yeah, Gurney for president. There are biker stickers still around.
I still think it's a great idea. He was again, one of the things about racers is they are so lively, their minds are so active, so multifaceted, they're so aware of things, and they can think on different levels, which is comes into play in racing cars. But you'd be talking with Dan and something fairly somber would come up, like perhaps danger, safety, someone who had been killed. And Don, Dan would be very somber, but then he would break up and start grinning and make a joke out of it. I mean, he was mercurial that way. And his laugh would just make you feel so good. His face just split wide open in a laugh. And if you were anywhere near him, you'd think, I feel good just watching that guy laugh. He's having such a good laugh.
He would actually listen to you.
Yes.
I got to talk to him. I was lucky enough, not as often as you, but I have gotten to talk to him several times. And I was just, I was really impressed that he would actually listen to what you were saying. A last conversation I had with him, and I didn't know it would be the last, as we never know. We were talking about brakes, and I said that I had been driving something with these weird brakes, and maybe we could improve them this way. And he said, yes, but then you'd get more heat. And I'm talking to Dan Gurney.
Yeah.
You got to spend your entire career talking to guys like him and in exotic locations and having a great time doing it. Again, folks, we're talking to Pete Lyons, whose book is available at PeteLyons.com. Tell us the name of the book one more time, Pete.
My Travels on Racer Road, underneath my name, Pete Lyons, and it's on my website at PeteLyons.com.
And how do you spell Lyons?
L-Y-O-N-S.
Well, Pete, we cannot thank you enough for being on the show. We got 58 minutes. We crammed your entire life into 58 minutes here, and I think we did a pretty good job of it.
It took me 3 years to write the book.
And we did it all in 57 minutes. We are out of time. Michelle Spencer, thank you again for being here. And be sure and stick around for whatever is next on KPFK. And we will see you next week here on The Car Show.
Cleanup after wildfires like Los Angeles has experienced is hazardous. The ash and dust that remain can be toxic since all kinds of materials were burned, including plastics, lead, asbestos, electronics, chemical products, and more.
Limpiar los escombros después de un incendio, como los ocurridos en el condado de Los Ángeles, es peligroso. La ceniza y el polvo que quedan pueden ser tóxicos, ya que se han quemado todo tipo de materiales, incluyendo plásticos, plomo, asbestos, aparatos electrónicos, productos químicos y más.
This is why wildfire cleanup can only be done by specially trained workers. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers can perform debris removal at no cost, but only after a right of entry form is submitted. The form can be found online at recovery.lacounty.gov, and the deadline to complete it is Monday, March 31st, 2025.
Por eso la limpieza después de un incendio en comunidades la deben realizar solamente trabajadores especialmente capacitados. Ingenieros del ejército están removiendo los escombros gratuitamente, pero solo para residentes que completen en línea una forma de derecho de entrada. Esta forma está disponible en Eliminación de Escombros, el Condado de Los Ángeles se recupera. Y la fecha límite para llenarla es el lunes 31 de marzo del 2025.
This message is brought to you by Radio Bilingüe Public Radio.
Support for KPFK comes in part from the Lemley Theaters, presenting Far Out, Life on and After the Commune, April 5th through the 7th at 5 of their LA theaters. A portion from the ticket sales will help fund KPFK Radio.